Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
At the close of its term, the Supreme Court of the United States issued its decision in Loper-Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. In its decision, it overturned what's come to be known as Chevron deference, named after the court's 1984 decision in Natural Resources Defense Council versus Chevron. And at the time of the decision, the Chevron decision, it didn't seem like a landmark decision from the court. But over time, the concept of Chevron deference had significant effects on agency policymaking. Chevron deference recommended a two-step approach towards the judicial review of whether an agency action was taken lawfully under the agency's action statute. Under the first step, a reviewing court was to evaluate whether the statute clearly granted the authority that the agency claimed for its action. And if the statute clearly spoke to the issue, the statute controlled. But if the statute was vague or ambiguous, courts would proceed to a second step, Chevron Step 2, and determine whether the agency construction was permissible and reasonable. If the agency construction of the statute was permissible and reasonable, the court would defer to the agency. Over time, Chevron deference became more controversial and, per Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Loper-Bright, more unworkable, and it seemed to authorize major policy shifts between administrations, with one administration claiming that its interpretation was reasonable, followed by another administration with a different perspective, claiming that perspective to be reasonable, and so on and so forth. We've come to talk about this on this podcast as regulatory whiplash. Finding Chevron to be inconsistent with the court's obligation to say what the law is under Article 3 of the Constitution, and finding it to be inconsistent with the Administrative Procedure Act's directive to decide all relevant questions of law, this Supreme Court overruled Chevron deference. Now, the decision managed to pick up quite a bit of press and quite a bit of criticism. So hopefully we're going to cut through the noise on this episode and get to what's really interesting about Loper-Bright and what we're looking for as the decision is applied in the lower courts and as the Supreme Court has ultimately a chance to opine again on what it means. I'm joined by Jeff Holmstead and Brittany Pemberton, both partners in our DC office, both with extensive administrative litigation experience. Jeff also provides his insights on the decision as informed by his time at EPA as the former assistant administrator of EPA for the Office of Air and Radiation. Hope you'll enjoy. Jeff, Brittany, listeners, lend me your ears. I come to bury Chevron, not to praise it, with apologies to English majors everywhere and my colleagues who have graciously joined me for a discussion on the decision in Loper-Bright Enterprises. We're sitting down a couple weeks after the Supreme Court decided to overrule Chevron, strike the deference canon from the books. So Jeff, Brittany, we've all written and spoken about this decision quite a bit at this point. We're recording, I guess, a couple of weeks after the decision. So we've seen a lot of discussions about what the decision means. But before we turn to that, one of the things I wanted to talk about is just the traction that this decision has gotten in the more mainstream press. And we've seen a lot of different perspectives on the significance of the Loper-Bright decision. Some writers have raised alarms that this decision is the end of the administrative state and EPA and all other sorts of agencies. Some have even said it's the end of the democracy in general. I think that we have a little bit more of a measured take on the significance of the decision for EPA, what it means for administrative agencies moving forward. And so if it's not the end of the government as we know it, what's the significance of this decision?
So I don't think it's the end of democracy or the end of the administrative state. I think a lot remains to be seen as to how great the impact of the decision will be, but that agencies have statutory mandates that they have to carry out, and they're going to continue to do that. I think that they will adapt their approach to rulemaking to address the court's opinion, probably starting with their own version of the best reading of the statute and really making a run at what that is and why, in order to back up the choices that they're making in rulemaking. And there may be more of that in a preamble to a rule than what we were seeing before. But I don't think that this is such a game changer that it means that agencies are paralyzed and they can't do anything. They have to do things and they'll continue to do things.
I think a lot of the commentary, Daniel, as you suggested, is way overblown. I think sort of on both sides of the issue, I think exaggerated exaggerate the extent to which this is going to fundamentally change the way our agencies approach these problems. I do think, as Brittany said, over time, and in fact, starting probably very, very soon, it will change the way that some agencies approach some of their regulations. They will need to be more circumspect. And I can say, based on my own experience for 5 years at EPA, in some cases where there was a tricky issue and agency folks, whether they be career folks or political folks, had a policy objective that seemed hard to square with the statute, at least exactly, that there was certainly discussion of Chevron deference and the idea that this particular issue is not firmly addressed in the statute and we can rely on the courts to give us deference here. I think that's certainly been part of the agency calculus. And I think this will constrain them both in terms of imposing new regulatory requirements, but also in terms of providing flexibility that may not be entirely consistent with the statutory language. So I do think that this will cut both ways, but I don't think we're going to see necessarily a sea change when it comes to federal regulation.
And Jeff, that point you brought up just towards the end was something that I had been thinking about. So many of the sort of overblown media pieces have described this as sort of an unmixed win for industry, that this is just going to benefit the regulated community who will be less regulated as a result of Chevron being overruled. But I'm not so sure that's the case, because on the one hand, it's absolutely the case that agencies pursue policies that don't always align with the clear statutory text. But then in other administrations, there are policies or guidance documents that provide flexibility that's still grounded in policy. It may be a policy that focuses more on economic productivity or leniency or what have you. So love to hear you talk about how agencies will have to grapple with that from the other side, not just in pursuing aggressive policy agendas, but and also providing that flexibility. And what should companies be thinking about as they approach agencies asking for some kind of flexibility with respect to an economic sector?
I think advocates on both sides are typically pretty good at explaining to the agencies why their view is the best reading of the statute. And we've seen that already, and that will continue to be the case. I also think that where we're likely to see this, at least in the Clean Air Act, is much more sort of in the application of longstanding policies to particular situations. And again, I don't necessarily want to go through all the details to put ideas in people's minds, but when it comes to the National Ambient Air Quality Standards and the implementation of those standards, the Clean Air Act is really based on a presumption that's turned out to be incorrect. Back in 1970, I think Congress and most commentators believed that it was just simply a matter of setting the standards, and then state and local governments would put in place more stringent regulations on their local industry, and everybody would come into attainment, and the Clean Air Act would have achieved its objective within a decade. And it turned out to be much more difficult than that. But the whole NAAQS program includes a lot of pretty detailed prescriptions and requirements that in some cases have just not been possible to meet. And EPA has dealt with those by, I think, reading flexibility into the statute that may not actually be there. As I look at the Clean Air Act, I think when it comes to SIP approvals and disapprovals, and even in some cases in permitting actions, we may see challenges to longstanding EPA policies, not necessarily regulations, but policies as they're applied in specific instances. It's going to be a matter of the same kind of regulatory advocacy and careful legal reasoning that we do now, but without the sort of possibility of Chevron deference being applied.
If I could jump in on the topic of whether this is an unmixed win for industry, I think one of the things that folks who are using language like that to describe Loper-Bright are overlooking is that a corollary to Chevron is what has enabled sort of pivoting in between administrations on different policies or different approaches to implementing certain statutory provisions. And previously, a new administration could change course if it showed that its new approach was permissible under the statute and there were good reasons for the change. Now, on judicial review, I don't think that's enough. The new interpretation obviously has to be the best reading of the statute, and that may be a challenge in some situations. In the instance where there's a change in the administration, where from a political perspective or a policy perspective, the new administration may be more willing to listen to industry or to work with industry to make certain programs a little more feasible, or however you want to put it. They may not have as strong of a toolbox, I think, to do that, or something that'll be as easy to defend on judicial review as they did previously.
Another one of my questions, and we're kind of already getting to it, is what comes after Chevron deference? It's not like there aren't other deference canons, or maybe we should call them respect canons. Now, the majority opinion in Loper-Bright talks especially about the importance of Skidmore versus Swift and Company. And that decision does look to sort of settled agency practice and its experience as an ability to inform the court as it goes through and tries to make sense of what the Clean Air Act means, or the Clean Water Act, or the Endangered Species Act. How is that decision going to affect these kinds of arguments moving forward? What should courts be looking out for? What is helpful to courts as they try to make those decisions?
I think the first point to make is one that Chief Justice Roberts made in his opinion, and that is, it is certainly the case that Congress can explicitly give agencies discretion by using broad terms like reasonable or appropriate or just and reasonable. And that sort of explicit delegation of discretion continues even after Loper-Bright. And within the bounds of that discretion, I think you can still see some variation going back and forth from administration to administration. But I just don't think we're going to see the same kind of dramatic swings that we've seen in the past. And the majority opinion pointed this out. In some ways, it's not like a whole new world, because there are many other cases that don't involve agencies where federal courts have to interpret statutes, and they use traditional tools of statutory construction to discern what they believe the best meaning is, and they apply those meaning in cases, and that happens all the time. When it comes to agency actions, as Brittany pointed out, and as you suggested, there is this idea that courts need to pay careful attention to the regulatory interpretations of the agency. And so to some extent, I think of it as a little bit like some of the cases where the court asked for the views of the Solicitor General, where they may read those briefs extra carefully. Mm-hmm. Agencies will still have an opportunity to persuade the courts, but they will need to be more careful in doing that, I think, based on traditional tools of statutory construction.
And it does seem like if we do see that sort of regulatory whiplash continuing to happen as one new administration comes into office and wants to change the policies of its predecessor, Skidmore suggests that a longstanding agency policy can't offer real explanatory help to the court. And if the regulatory whiplash problem keeps happening, then the agency will be able to provide less of that sort of explanatory help based on settled practices to the court. And what will happen is that the court will have to be more direct in providing that sort of best reading and settling the question, at least until Congress steps in to change the law. So one of the questions that came up in oral argument, that came up in the dissents, was what happens to all of the decisions under Chevron deference? I think that we've spent so much time talking about the statistics of how frequently Chevron is cited in court opinions and scholarship. I think it's the most cited administrative law case, and I'm sure it's in the running for one of the most cited cases generally. The dissents seemed especially concerned with what Loper-Bright would mean for all of the decisions previously that were based on Chevron deference. What does the court say is going to happen with those decisions?
The Chief Justice certainly thinks that not much. I think he's at least trying to project the view that there's nothing to be afraid of in terms of a tidal wave of reopening all of these long settled rules or rules that have been litigated and upheld. He uses the phrase statutory stare decisis to refer to that, and says that really, if you're going to take a run at those rules, you need a special justification to overcome the particular flavor of stare decisis, the reliance on precedent that's extra strong with statutory interpretation. I don't know that that's entirely persuasive, and I think a lot will remain to be seen. And again, I don't mean to suggest that there's going to be a massive tidal wave of litigation. I think there will certainly be some folks taking a run at longstanding regulations or policies as a result of the case, but I don't know that it's as clear cut as he makes it seem. I think if a case was upheld by the Supreme Court under Chevron Step 1, then yeah, I don't think Loper Bright helps you very much, but I don't know that it applies really the same across the board. If we're talking about Chevron step two, it's sort of inherent in that there wasn't an obvious single best reading of the statute, perhaps. The statute wasn't clear. The court either found some ambiguity or there was some silence that the agency tried to gap fill. And so then if the rule's been upheld under step two, it doesn't necessarily mean that the court is deferred and that the best reading of the statute may or may not have been established at this point. I think there is room in there for folks that are inclined to take another crack at some things.
Although, Brittany, I have a question for you. How does that work? If the agency does not take further action, if the rule has already been litigated and resolved, under the Clean Air Act, the Corner Post decision doesn't give anyone an opportunity to come back again and try to challenge a rule that's already been upheld. So like in the Clean Air Act and other statutes that have specific deadlines by which challenges have to be brought, if those challenges were brought, a rule was upheld, the agency doesn't make further changes to the rule, how is it that people would be able to go back and sort of re-challenge those rules that were upheld based on step two of Chevron?
Yeah, you're making a good correction. I don't mean to suggest that I think it's available for every statute or every rule out there. And obviously the Clean Air Act gives us a good example of when it might be really a stretch because of that 60-day, very clear statute of limitations that's present in the statute. I think it's possible for folks to try to invent some reason to argue some kind of reopening of the rule, depending upon just what's going on in the regulatory arena, possible to file some petition for reconsideration if you have a more friendly administration, I think. Clean Air Act, maybe you could get creative about a grounds arising after suit, something like that as well. I don't litigate nearly as much under other statutes as I do the Clean Air Act, so I don't want to go too far out on a limb on what else might be possible there. But I think folks that really want to take a run at things will try some creative stuff, even when it comes to the 60-day statute of limitations. And then, of course, I think you mentioned the Corner Post decision for cases that are not under the Clean Air Act or under some similar federal regime that has a clear statute of limitations. There's now, I think, perhaps a much longer opportunity to litigate some of these rules or agency actions.
No, I do think that's certainly the case. I don't know how big that universe is.
Right.
But Corner Post, in some ways, the combination of Corner Post and Loper Bright is going to invite challenges to some universe of rules. And it will be interesting to see how the principles of statutory stare decisis come into play there.
And I hadn't done much of my own reading on statutory stare decisis until I read Loper Bright and saw the sort of role that it played in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. I was interested to find out, and I think this is maybe one of the biggest examples of statutory stare decisis with Major League Baseball, where Major League Baseball was ruled to be exempt from the Sherman Antitrust Act because it was an exhibition game strictly under state law. And this decision was handed down by the Supreme Court in like the 1920s. I think we're coming up on like, and we may have already passed the 100th year of that decision. And it's been challenged several times, sometimes going all the way up to the Supreme Court on other issues. And every time the Supreme Court has said, no, the MLB is still exempt, even though it is a multi-billion dollar entertainment franchise. And so I thought that was really interesting that they continue to hold to that thing. So I think there's some real teeth to statutory stare decisis and the court's willingness to stand by decisions, even if they were decided under Chevron step two. It'll be interesting to see what that looks like, especially in like the lower courts, right? And your district courts and your courts of appeals. But I do think that that's a really interesting aspect of how this is going to play out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot remains to be seen because we just need to live with the new regime here for a number of years to really see how it plays out in the lower courts and to see where the Supreme Court may be willing to jump in again to provide some clarity if it's needed.
The next few years will be interesting as lower courts sort of struggle with the contours of these new doctrines. But certainly Loper Bright, especially in connection with Corner Post, is likely to lead to a fair amount of litigation, at least over some longstanding rules.
And I think when I was reading the decision when it came out, you could almost imagine a number of attorneys sitting down to file amended complaints to raise Loper Bright as a specific challenge to a new regulation. What we had seen, I guess, before was that so many of the significant regulations that we deal with were alleged by a variety of plaintiffs to violate the major questions doctrine. And that became almost like your default claim one for against some of these rules and major regulations that they had run afoul of the major questions doctrine. But I can see something similar happening where many, many new complaints cite directly to this case and what it stands for.
Oh, I suspect it will be cited fairly often. Yeah, I think there's no question about that. How often that will be successful, it remains to be seen. And I think, Daniel, we've talked before, I think the major questions doctrine has been vastly overused by litigants seeking to find a major question in every single or many challenges. And I think we haven't really seen how those cases play out, but I suspect that over time, that doctrine will be found to be relatively narrow.
I was wondering much the same thing with the emphasis in both decisions, West Virginia v. EPA and Loper Bright. They're both grounded in basically the same approach. They both counsel a very similar approach to use all the tools of statutory construction to provide the best reading of the statute. And the best reading of the statute allows an agency to make the kinds of major economic changes to a particular industry, then it can proceed. In some ways, I think that Loper Bright will ultimately replace West Virginia versus EPA in all but the most sort of rarefied cases.
I think that's right. I do think that's right. I should go back and maybe correct a misimpression in emphasizing that this ruling will sort of cut in both directions, both in favor of those who are seeking to limit agency actions and those who would like to make them more stringent. I think on balance, Loper Bright will tend to sort of reduce the regulatory burden over time, because I do think that in general, Chevron discretion has been used much more to justify regulatory requirements than it has been used to provide flexibility. So although I think it cuts both ways, I think in general, the commentary has been correct that it will constrain what many of us see as regulatory overreach.
I think one of the things that is also helpful about the decision is that in talking about that sort of regulatory back and forth, it seemed like during some administrations, you would have preambles that were almost exclusively based on scientific research and the policy desirability of a particular regulation. And then in other administrations, you would see sort of a step back from that. And those preambles, I'm thinking of the Navigable Waters Protection Rule under the Clean Water Act. Just a huge portion of that preamble just read almost like a brief, talking about previous Supreme Court decisions and other decisions in the lower courts and what Waters of the United States really, really meant after all. And it seems like I think this will be helpful just for an agency's effort to sort of ground its rules in a particular statute. I think we're going to see more of that in preambles as agencies seek to, on the front end, make it clear that what they're doing, regardless of the administration, regardless of what they're trying to do, is grounded in the statute, grounded in the best reading of the statute. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. Like both of you say, we're kind of having this conversation a few years too early to see what the real impact of the decision will be, but I'm making that prediction. My prediction about Loper Bright was totally off. I thought that they were going to find a way to maintain Chevron, but just reemphasize that, hey, you do statutory interpretation first. So my predictions aren't very, very useful, but I'm just logging that for the record.
That's very humble of you to admit it.
I'd kind of come up with the decision and Kaiser v. Wilkie on a court's deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations lulled me into sort of a false sense of security with Chevron. And that actually comes up in a couple of the dissents or in the dissent in Loper Bright. I kind of been reading Loper Bright and Corner Post lately, so I've got two dissents in mind. But Justice Kagan mentioned that not too long ago, we upheld our deference, but here the court's going in a different direction. So anyways, all that is just a long ramble on why I'm not good at predicting Supreme Court outcomes, even after a few years of paying attention to what the court's doing in the administrative context.
You're not the only one in that boat.
Any other thoughts? Anything pressing just that is your favorite aspect of Loper Bright that you want to share with our listenership?
Over the pandemic, a law professor from UVA, who's a pretty highly regarded, wrote a book, I think, called Chevron Deference or The Rise and Fall of Chevron Deference and the Future of the Administrative State. And maybe it's only those of us who are steeped in administrative law who have any interest in it. But he recounts the history of Chevron, and I think it's very well summarized in the Chief Justice's opinion, that when the Chevron decision came down, certainly the author of the decision and the other justices, the other, I guess, five justices, because there's only six justices involved, clearly did not regard it as a landmark decision. And Justice Roberts, I think, recounts some of this. I think it's very interesting to look at how it became such an important decision when it really was not intended that way by the original authors. And I think it's only after having lived with it now for 40 years, people have really began to work through the implications of it that we've finally seen it overruled. But this is not one of those cases where the Supreme Court made a momentous decision and then came along some years later and changed it. This was almost an accidental landmark. And I think the original decision doesn't really work through all the implications. And I think Justice Roberts does a good job of pointing that out. So it's kind of a long decision, but I did find the history to be quite interesting.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. If the Supreme Court justices at the time didn't understand themselves to be doing something really significant with respect to the administrative state, right? And then they might not think, well, we need to make sure that our I's are dotted and our T's are crossed. Then we talk about how this is grounded in the Administrative Procedure Act or Article 3. And so it's sort of understandable that they might not think to do that in the 80s when they didn't understand themselves to be issuing something so momentous. But then, of course, as you point out, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion talks about how, well, regardless of what they did originally, we have to think about that now. And ultimately, Chevron isn't a good fit for the APA.
The other question that I thought a bit about, and I suspect both of you have too, is the decision cites both constitutional reasons and statutory reasons for overruling Chevron, but it seems to rely more heavily on the language in the Administrative Procedure Act, which raises the question, if a future Congress came along and decided that they wanted to codify Chevron as a principle of statutory construction, I mean, would that even be permissible constitutionally? I think the majority opinion leaves that question kind of up in the air.
I agree. I think, though, that at least Justice Thomas's concurrence would go further. He says that this is really not consistent with constitutional separation of powers. And I think it's telling that Chief Justice Roberts didn't ground his decision explicitly on separation of powers issues.
No. And very clearly, it mentioned those constitutional principles, but the holding seems to be more squarely based on the APA. I think it's unlikely anytime soon that we'll have a Congress that will come along and try to codify Chevron as a principle of statutory interpretation. But that's an interesting issue to contemplate.
What else I think is an interesting issue? There was, I think, quite a bit made at oral argument about the fact that Chevron didn't cite to the APA at all. It was really a Clean Air Act case. And now what we have is Loper Bright, which overturned Chevron and doesn't talk about the Clean Air Act at all, but instead talks about the APA. I don't really know what to make about that, but I'm curious to see if either one of you have a reaction.
Well, the Clean Air Act is really so much more your world, Brittany and Jeff, although I find myself increasingly being drawn into it.
Hard to resist the gravitational pull.
I know, absolutely. It's just so massive and it gravity's correct. So I'll hold off on having an opinion on that. But of course, Jeff, I'd love to hear from you.
I'm not sure what to make of that. But to me, one of the lessons is the Supreme Court adopted a framework that none of the litigants had really briefed. Right? Had the agency proposed that or had one of the litigants proposed that, they probably would have considered what the APA said. But because this was sort of invented and invented. And again, this sounds too critical, but I think it sort of seemed like a sensible approach. But it's pretty clear that at the time, the justices hadn't sort of carefully thought this through. And Thomas Merrill's book makes that very clear. He goes back into the notes from the various justices and exactly what we know about their deliberations. And it just was not an opinion that got a lot of attention from any of the justices. And it was only some years later when the D.C. Circuit sort of latched onto it as a new groundbreaking canon of statutory construction that it became what it ultimately became those many years later. I mean, and the Supreme Court, as I think Chief Justice Roberts points out, in that term and the subsequent term, they did decide many other cases that involved agency interpretations of statutes, and they never referred back to Chevron. It was only after the D.C. Circuit's on a decision in that GM case that it all of a sudden became this new approach to statutory construction that the Supreme Court supported for many years until it didn't.
There's this nice couple of pages in Justice Gorsuch's concurrence where he talks about how Justice Scalia became initially one of the biggest proponents of Chevron deference, really back then to cut down on sort of looking at legislative history, right? Not as a deference canon in itself that would just sort of enable regulatory shifts administration to administration, but really as a way to focus back on the statute and where the gaps are and where they aren't before ultimately he became a critic of it. Jeff, you mentioned that it may be unlikely that Congress comes along to amend the APA and make something like Chevron deference a part of the statute. But one thing that may be interesting to watch in future congressional activity is one of the things that Justice Roberts mentioned, and Jeff, you mentioned it earlier, just committing things to agency discretion, sort of a la carte commitments to agency discretion, going amendment by amendment, statute by statute as they come up and saying, well, this set of decisions is really committed to the agency and its reasonable policymaking initiatives. So that'll be interesting to see if we see more of that come up because Chevron's gone.
I think it's hard to see a whole lot of activity on any of it at this point in time, but you never know. A future Congress may get there.
That does seem to be one of the things that the opinion is hoping to see.
Yeah, I think we've seen that in more than one Supreme Court decision this term. The author of the majority opinion for the court really coming out and saying, and if you don't like it, Congress, you still have the option to regulate or to legislate in the space here.
That's right. We've talked a couple of times about corner posts now. That was a big part of Justice Barrett's majority opinion. It's not like we don't have anything else to look forward to and for the rest of the year on the political development front. But thank you both for popping into the studio, so to speak, and sharing your thoughts on this decision.
Thank you. This has been an interesting discussion, and we should have it again in 5 years after we see how things play out.
Okay. I'll send you guys a calendar invite.
Maybe you want to make a prediction, Daniel, so that we can see whether your record improves.
Oh, no. My only prediction now is that my predictions are generally bad. That's the only way to get my numbers back up.
Well, thank you. It has been fun.
That's it for us today at the Environmental Law Monitor. Big thanks to our guests, as well as Dorn, Emily, and the rest of our production team who helped to make this episode possible. And of course, thank you, our listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.